Meeting will come to order.
Order in the meeting.
Good afternoon, everybody. We have a very interesting agenda for today, and I'd like to have us get started because we're going to hear first a very brief overview from Ms. Aves with House Research and then Mr. Kerber. But before we do that, do I have a motion to approve the minutes of February?
Madam Chair.
Representative Ward, we don't have a quorum yet, so we'll wait on the minutes till we have a quorum. Okay, but we will get started with our agenda because we do want to cover a lot of ground today. So, Ms. Aves, if you would like to get us started here talking about issues surrounding infant health and safety.
Madam Chair and members, there should be a one-page handout in your packets, and if it isn't in there, we can get you copies. Just to give you a brief outline of the number of child care providers that are licensed in the state and their capacity for child care, for the number of children they can care for, the numbers of children receiving child care assistance, basic sliding fee scale, and MFIP child care that are enrolled in licensed and legal unlicensed child care facilities per month, and then the ratio of children receiving child care assistance based on their ages 0 through age 14. That's just to give you a little bit of a perspective about the number of children that are receiving child care. And when you hear from Mr. Kerber about the child death review, you can kind of keep in mind how many kids are receiving child care in the state.
Thank you, Ms. Aves. And just so for members to find it in your packets, it's in with House File 220 inside the green sleeve if you haven't located it. Thank you, Ms. Aves. So next up is Mr. Kerber. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the Inspector General for the Department of Human Services. And I've been asked to talk a little bit about our safe sleep proposal that we're proceeding with. And we'll just kind of back up a little bit, following up what Ms. Aves said about child care licensing. And one thing that's important to know with child care licensing is that there really are two models of child care generally. There are child care centers, and then there's family child care. And child care centers, as she noted, there are about 1,600 of them around the state. And the licensing arrangement for that is that all of the work related to those types of services is completed by state employees in the Department of Human Services. So applications are received and reviewed, and site visits are made, complaints are investigated. Any kind of licensing sanctions are issued by the Department of Human Services directly. For the 1,100 family child care providers, the model is a little different in that the licenses are still issued by the Department of Human Services, but the monitoring activities and the processing of applications and investigation of complaints, those activities are all completed by counties. And so counties have certain responsibilities and authorities that are identified in the Human Services Licensing Act, and so counties can do things like issue some variances to licensing rules, and they can issue correction orders. If there's a sanction that seems appropriate, then the county makes a recommendation to the department, and it's really our agency that then issues that sanction. So there's just two different systems in place here. For family child care, there's about 150 licensors out there throughout the state to do the licensing work for those 11,000 programs. And at the state level, we have about nine licensors for the 1,600. So I'm just going to proceed and talk about a little background on how we ended up with our proposal that is really focused on enhancing the safe sleep practices in family child care. And Madam Chair, I understand I have about 15 minutes, so I'll try and get through this. This all started for us at the end of 2011 and the beginning of 2012 when Commissioner Jessen asked the Licensing Division to do an annual report that summarized activities that we had undertaken in the previous year, and also importantly to see whether or not there were any trends that we could identify. And that was kind of a new activity for us in that we spend a lot of time looking at individual trees, but we don't often step back and look at the whole forest. And so we did that in this case. And one of the things that kind of jumped out at us is the increasing number of temporary immediate suspensions that we were issuing in family child care settings. And a temporary immediate suspension is the really the most serious licensing sanction we can issue in that its effect is immediate, in that a provider is immediately shut down. They have an appeal. There's a whole host of appeal rights, certainly, but those appeal rights are enjoyed after they're closed. And so there's a very high standard in the law for us to issue one of those sanctions, and that there has to be imminent danger to infants or to children in care. And so we have been issuing more of those, we had found. And then as we looked at those, we also saw that more of those were related to deaths. And in fact, in that year, there were eight. In 2011, there were eight of those temporary immediate suspensions that we had issued that were related to deaths of infants. And that caused us some concern. And so we went back and we looked more at our own data and saw that when we look back over the previous 10 years, the first 10 years we had had an average of six deaths per year in family child care. And in the later 10 years, we had had an average of 11. And some other ways that we looked at this is that from 2006 until 2000, from 2002 to 2006, that five-year period, there were a total of 26 deaths in all of child care. And for the next five-year period, there were 51 deaths. So it went from 26 in 5 years to 51 in the next 5 years. And the way that broke down for family child care and centers was that 25 of the 26 in the first 5 years were family child care, and 49 of the 51 in the second 5 years were family child care. And so all told, there were, 83 deaths total in family child care during that time period. And in the 83, there were another nine deaths that had occurred while we were looking at this data. We had another nine in the first 6 months of 2012. So we decided this is a serious health issue for family child care, for families that are relying on family child care. And we were a little bit perplexed by it. So in that period, there were 86, some of these numbers, 86 for family child care and three for child care centers. So during that same 10-year period, 86 and 3. And so trying to figure out how to put this in perspective, we started looking at, well, how many kids are there in care on any given day? And in family child care, we know that there are probably about 90,000 kids receiving family child care on any given day throughout the state. And in child care centers, there are about 60,000 kids receiving care on any given day. So there's like 1.5 times as many children are receiving care in family child care as are receiving care in child care centers. But when we compare that to the rate of there being deaths of children in family child care, it was 28 to 1. So we had 1.5 times as many kids in care in one setting compared to the other, but 28 times as many deaths of kids in care. And so there's obviously a disparate representation there. And as we started looking at this, we certainly recognize that there's always more research that can be done about, why are there more deaths in one setting versus another one. And some people have pointed out to us that when we're looking at this, when I'm talking about the number of children, 60,000 and 90,000 on any given day, I'm not breaking that down into how many of those are infants and what's the relative infant ratio across those settings. Frankly, we don't know that. But what we do know is that when we looked at these deaths of the 83 children who died in family child care, 75% of them, 75% of those deaths were infants in an unsafe sleep situation. So 65 of the 83 deaths in family child care occurred when there was an infant in an unsafe sleep condition. So that was pretty alarming to us. And certainly it caused us to sort of focus our attention on the safe sleep requirements. So what was going on? And so when I say they were in an unsafe sleep condition, that means that the provider was not in compliance with one of the licensing standards that we had in place. Okay, so it was the licensing standards are what they are, and a provider had deviated from that on that day. So so that's what we really decided that our focus needed to be on those safe sleep requirements. Sometimes there's a discussion of SIDS related to this, and you know, some of the feedback that you've probably heard is that, you know, the department is interested in coming up with regulations that are going to seemingly prevent SIDS from happening. And we're not really technically talking about SIDS. I mean, SIDS is a medical diagnosis that's made after an infant has died that's kind of ruling out every other cause. And so we're not really talking about that. What we're talking about is trying to enhance provider compliance with the safe sleep requirements. Interestingly, the safe sleep requirements are often called SIDS reduction activities or risk SIDS risk reduction, because there is an association between an increased likelihood of SIDS in some of these unsafe conditions. But nevertheless, we're not really focused on SIDS so much as we're focused on really those other deaths that have occurred where in many cases the infant was found not breathing with its face buried in a pillow that was in the crib, or buried in a blanket, or an infant was sleeping in a car seat and had choked when nobody was watching. The infant had choked on the strap of the car seat. I mean, some of these things are really quite tragic. So one of the things that we did, though, at that point is we asked the Child Mortality Review Panel to take a look at these. And the Child Mortality Review Panel is a group that meets quarterly, has since 1990 or so, and it's established by statute to take a look at the deaths of children that when those deaths occur in either a licensed program or they're involved with a family that is somehow involved with the child protection system, or when the county looked at that death, county child protection, they had some reason to believe there was maltreatment, maybe some neglect. And so those three categories of deaths are reviewed regularly by this Child Mortality Review Panel. And so the Child Mortality Review Panel had actually reviewed each of these deaths individually, but we asked them to go back and look at them collectively now, as we were trying to do, and see if they could see any trends or if they could identify any perhaps licensing standards that they thought maybe had contributed to this. And so they issued a report. The Child Mortality Review Panel issued the report, I believe that was in August, and you probably heard about that report when it came out. There were a number of recommendations in that report. I believe there were 34 different recommendations that were made. And the recommendations in some cases were fairly extreme in that they would have a pretty dramatic impact on family child care in Minnesota. One of the things that we know is that there are a lot of families that are already priced out of licensed child care, and we know that there's a lot of families that are priced out of child care centers. And so while we know that many people choose family child care for many good reasons, it's also, in many cases, the child care that's affordable. And some of the recommendations were pretty dramatic in the way of perhaps lowering the license capacity or changing the racial requirements or changing training requirements or changing initial credentials to get licensed. And so we reviewed those carefully, but what we thought to be most important is to review. We started at that point getting a lot of feedback from licensed family child care providers. And so we took advantage of that, and we had some community meetings, and we really were eliciting feedback from providers to get their reactions not only to that report, but what were their recommendations relative to this problem that we were facing.
Mr. Kerber, since you're taking a pause here, let me just give you a chance to take a breath. First of all, I'm going to call the meeting officially to order because we do have a quorum. And Representative Ward is going to move the minutes for us.
Madam Chair, I move that we accept the minutes for the February 12th meeting.
Okay. Representative Ward moves the minutes for February 12th, 2013. Any discussion to that? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Thank you very much. And I also, while we're paused, some of you members might have noticed the room kind of filled up here. And I would like to extend a welcome to some of the members of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. So we have in the room a lot of pediatricians and residents in training to be pediatricians, and what a wonderful day for them to be here. So let's give them a welcome. And I just want to let them know that you can really fill in any seats, including the ones that are in the back here. There are a few, and you might feel more uncomfortable sitting back there, but you're welcome to sit there and go in and out as you need to. And we are discussing the very important topic of child mortality in licensed child care, and Mr. Kerber from the Department of Human Services is explaining to us about the child mortality report and the department's response to that. So thank you, Mr. Kerber. And and we do have one question, actually. Representative Franson, did you want to? Okay, thank you. Okay, please proceed, Mr. Kerber.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. You know, the Child Mortality Review Panel report was issued and was publicized, and one of the things that was very helpful in this process is that the Minneapolis paper was actually doing a series on these issues, and what that really caused is that people started talking about these issues regarding infants dying in family child care in ways that they hadn't before, and certainly people read that Child Mortality Review Panel and had their own reactions to it, and we heard a lot of those, and I'm sure you did too. Some of the reactions from people were sort of understanding, they had a misunderstanding that these recommendations were now in force and that the Department of Human Services are going to start enforcing them. Certainly that was not the case. Others perceived these to be recommendations from the commissioner and from the department to the legislature, and they weren't that either. What they were was this review panel's recommendations to the department, to the Commissioner of Human Services, for review so that we could take a look at them and then and go from there. And so that's what we did. And we had community meetings. We had three of them. We had one in St. Cloud, one in Rochester, and one in St. Paul. We met with parents who use family child care. We had a meeting. The commissioner and I met with a young couple whose infant had died in family child care on the eighth day of using care. His face was found buried in a pillow and not breathing. So we heard a lot of stories, and some were very troubling. We got a lot of feedback too about us. We got a lot of feedback about the Department of Human Services, as you can imagine. Some of the feedback all the feedback was great, but some of the themes were that there was not necessarily the consistency that people would like to see in the enforcement, and that did play some role. We heard a lot of stories about how people got different answers from different licensors within the county, and they called the state and they maybe got another answer, differences between counties, and so we heard enough of that and enough of those examples as they related to what are the actual requirements for safe sleep, that we knew we had to address that issue. We also heard a lot about the training that's available and that the training had been outdated, and that it wasn't necessarily available throughout the state. And that people were not necessarily opposed to increasing the training requirements, but they really wanted there to be some financial support for that or make the training reasonably priced. Both of those we're pursuing. And the third one that we heard is that it's time for us to start using technology better at the department, and that where there are, and this is all in the area of becoming more consistent, is that we can use our website to provide interpretations of some of these licensing standards a lot more than we have been. And so there shouldn't be so much ambiguity about what is actually required. And through better communication on our part, there will be more consistent understanding throughout the state on what some of the expectations are for family child care providers. But we also discovered that there are some regulations that need changing. And so we are proposing some changes to our licensing standards. And one of them, I'll just go through them quickly. One of them is actually the same as Representative Fritz is proposing, in that we want to return back to the time when only physicians could order that an infant sleep in a position other than on its back. That had been sort of the case. I mean, we were sort of requiring that without the clear authority up until 2007, and then we were seeking clarification that of that authority and statute, and it actually went the other way, and so it became law that parents could make that decision. And we think that, you know, by having it a physician's order only, that it's going to really enhance everybody's understanding of the seriousness of that deviation. Similar to the training issue, we know that in these cases where infants have died, the providers knew that they were supposed to be sleeping the infants on their back. They knew what they should be doing, but they didn't apparently understand how important it was. And they had other reasons for deviating from that. And so this is one of those things that's going to hopefully enhance the seriousness of it. We are going to be clarifying some of the standards about when you can have a loose blanket in a crib. There's still some ambiguity about that, and so one of our amendments is going to be clarifying that. On the training issue, I mentioned we're going to be requiring a little bit more training. The mortality review panel recommended 24 hours a year for family child care providers. Currently, they're required to have 8. 24 is pretty extreme, and when we looked at that, we looked at not what's the magic number here for training hours, but we looked at really what's the content that needs to be that people need to be refreshed on an annual basis, and we came up with 16 by looking at the topics, and so we're going to be increasing that to 16 hours a year from 8. That's a proposal, and that some of the specific training is going to be increasing in frequency. CPR training right now is required only every 3 years, and we want to move that up to every 2 years. And that's also going to be changing in that it's going to have a demonstration component required with a pediatric focus as well. And that's kind of relevant because in some of these cases when the provider discovered an infant not breathing, 911 wasn't the first call. It may have been the provider's husband. It may have been the provider's minister. There were other calls made before 911 was called and before CPR was started. And so we think that if there's a little bit more familiarity here, people are going to respond a little more quickly. The second area is abusive head trauma. That's the new term that we're substituting for shaken baby syndrome. It's a newer term in the industry. And rather than requiring that every 5 years, we want to make that annually.
Mr. Gerber, I have a question about that. Mm-hmm. Are these changes that you're making just to licensing standards that don't require any change in legislation, or are there bills moving somewhere else addressing these issues?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question. Most of these changes I'm talking about in this section are really changes that are going to be required in statute, and so they're included. They'll be included in the language that accompanies the governor's budget when that
okay.
finally comes out.
Thank you.
Yeah. So the shaken baby, or now called abusive head trauma, training will be we're recommending that be every year instead of every 5 years. And the nexus there, you know, and I want to step back a little bit here. What we tried to do with our recommendations is really tie them as closely as we could to infants dying in family child care. There was certainly an interest by many people, a noble interest in sort of looking at the quality of family child care as a whole, and maybe, you know, this is a crisis situation that can be maybe used to enhance the quality overall to meet some other national standards that people find important. That really wasn't our focus. Our focus was really on how are we going to target in on these infant death situations and the safe sleep. And so as that relates to the shaken baby or abusive head trauma, the training that people get for that is relevant in that what we know about some of these infants being put down in the inappropriate position is that it's done sometimes because we know that infants sometimes fall asleep easier when they're put on their stomach. When they're put on their back, sometimes they remain distressed for a long period of time. There's nothing in the crib, and you know they sometimes cry themselves to sleep. We know that sometimes if you put an infant on the stomach, it might go to sleep sooner, and some people argue it sleeps better. So there have been some temptations when a provider may be frazzled with all the activity going on to put the infant down to get some relief. the shaken baby training kind of focuses on that too, that this is training where people find out not just don't shake a baby. I mean, that should be a really short training, just don't do it. But this is really like, instead, when you're feeling like you want to shake this infant, what should you do instead? What are other ways that you can cope with this? You know, sometimes I can only imagine how stressful the environment is with all these children in care. That's how that one's relevant. And then the last one is really the one that's right on topic here, is a sudden unexpected infant death. We're changing that term from SIDS, sudden infant death, to sudden unexpected infant death, moving away from that medical diagnosis. It's really still the more generic, a sudden unexpected infant death. But that training, we want to have that every year. And it's going to be updated, and this training is going to be made available throughout the state. Some of the money that you'll see in the bill, the request for appropriation, is going to be related to that training. And there still will be a cost for providers, but we're trying to get it down to about $5 an hour so that it's reasonable. Another one of the changes that we're recommending, and you may have heard some about this, is we're recommending that there be more checks on sleeping infants. The Mortality Review Panel report recommended that infants be checked every 15 minutes and that there be an audio or video monitor. We're saying there should be a monitor in place if you're not in the room with the infant sleeping, but that the checks should be done every 15 minutes, but only for the first 4 weeks of care, or if the infant is having some kind of respiratory distress. Sadly, we know that there are an awful lot of these infants that die in that first 4 weeks of care when they're making that adjustment, and surprisingly, there are several on that first day of family child care. And so that first 4 weeks, we think, is sort of a transition time. And so if an infant is sleeping, you know, we're recommending that they be checked on every 15 minutes. There are some other regulations that we think need some clarification, and you may have heard some about this too. Well, some of the language in the bill will talk about when an infant falls asleep in a stroller, or an infant falls asleep in a swing, or an infant falls asleep in a carrier, or if an infant falls asleep while you're holding the infant, is the Department of Human Services saying that you need to wake up that baby? And the answer is certainly no, that's not the case. But there is an expectation that infants are put to sleep in that safe sleep arrangement in a crib. But we recognize that infants are going to fall asleep, and if you're in the car, if you're on a walk and you have a stroller. But so the expectation is that when you return back to the home, that as soon as practicable, that infant gets moved into the crib situation. But in the meantime, the infant should be within your supervision, within sight of the provider. And you should make sure there's nothing covering his head or blocking his airway and those kinds of things. And then similarly, as it relates to holding an infant, I mean, we got a lot of feedback from people saying that they understood that we were saying you couldn't ever hold an infant if it fell asleep, and you know that's not the case. But you'll see in the language is that if a provider is holding an infant that's sleeping, ideally the infant's going to be moved to a safe sleep arrangement in a crib. But in the meantime, in determining when that needs to occur, it should be based on their ability to meet the needs of the other perhaps 11 kids in care. If you're holding an infant, can you serve the other kids is kind of the issue. We had one provider who said that she wasn't going to need any cribs because she was always going to hold the sleeping infants. And, you know, with other kids in care, it didn't seem to work. And one that you're going to hear more about, and I think we'll have more discussion about, is liability insurance. Right now, family child care providers are expected to have liability insurance, and many, many do. But if they don't, they're required to tell the parents of the kids in care that they don't have it, and they're required to do that in writing. Sadly, in a couple of these infant death situations, the parents only learned that the provider had let that insurance policy lapse after the death had occurred. And we're looking at the kind of the nexus here is that this is, you know, insurance companies are going to be monitoring, you know, compliance by providers, and we're thinking this is one more incentive for providers to remain compliant with the safe sleep requirements.
Okay. Can you wrap it up, Mr. Kerr?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then I want to get we have our licensing lookup online. where we, at the Department of Human Services, you can go online and you can find family child care providers. You can find child care centers. You can find any of the other, the 24,000 programs that we license. There's information about them. For the programs that we license directly, like child care centers, there's a lot more information and what's than there is for family child care. And what's missing for family child care are correction orders that are issued by counties. And so we're one of our proposals here is to move forward with posting more documents that we get from counties. And so that pretty much wraps it up, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Kerber. And we have some questions that I just want to say. A lot of what Mr. Kerber talked about is actually not going to be heard in this committee, although we appreciate getting that overview. But these pieces about liability insurance and other kinds of new rules for providers will really be heard in Representative Mullery's committee. So we're going to try to focus today as much as we can on the safe sleep piece. Mm-hmm. And Representative Franson had a question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thanks, Mr. Kerber. I'm glad that you put on the record regarding the holding infant, because a lot of providers have, you know, said to me, and the licensors across the state seem to be still unclear on that issue. So I don't know if your department can let your licensors know that, yes, indeed, providers are allowed to hold a sleeping baby as long as the needs of the other children are being met. And then regarding, are we on to the bill yet? We're not on to the bill, are we?
Not yet.
Okay. Then I have more questions, but I'll wait until the bill.
All right. Mr. Kerber?
Oh, actually, no, I will take it, if you don't mind.
Okay.
This isn't, and it's not, it's in the bill, but it's not to the bill. Could you please clarify regarding cribs, pack and plays, or whatever you want to call them? There's some licensors that believe that the rule does not allow any blanket, not even a receiving blanket, to be put on top of a sleeping child to keep the baby warm. So could you is that true? Are providers are not allowed to have anything in that crib at all?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Representative Franson, yes, that is true. We are going to be clarifying a lot of the expectations regarding the pack and plays. They have their own world of issues. You know, there's one of the requirements that's currently in the law is that providers have to check against the Consumer Product Safety Commission's website to see if their crib has been recalled. A lot of that's dramatically changing now because of other federal standards that have gone into place. First, it was the manufacturers were controlled and they couldn't make cribs that didn't meet certain standards, and then retailers couldn't sell them, and then now we're rolling out, and now at this point, no, you know, commercial child care providers can't have a crib that isn't certified. So, but the pack and play issue is right in there too, and so we're going to have some standards made clear.
Representative Franson.
Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Kerber. I think that we misunderstood each other. I'm talking about the infant who is sleeping, not being allowed to have a receiving blanket in covering that sleeping child up. Because as the rule states, it says the license holder must not place pillows, quilts, comforters, sheepskin, pillow-like stuffed toys, or other soft products in the crib with the infant. Does that also include a receiving blanket? Or is that infant to sleep with nothing, just its clothes or jammies?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, our clarifications will be that there should be nothing in the crib with the infant, right? Not even a receiving blanket. And that's consistent with the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendations.
And thank you, Mr. Corrin. I'm sure that if we polled the audience, we could probably find 30 experts on that very point right here. Representative Franson.
We'll take this offline.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I might just add to that on the issue of the consistency. I mean, that's exactly the issue that we heard a lot about. Is, you know, for different topics, different subtopics, but one of our charges here is to make information more available. We're going to be training county licensors on what the expectations are, and we're going to be posting that information on the clarifications.
Mr. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kerber, thank you so much, because that is one of the biggest complaints that I get, is just the licensors are not one with each other, and that they interpret the legislation differently than in another county. So if we could speed that up, that would be helpful. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, we have some other questions for Mr. Kerber, and I'm happy to do that, and he's our expert on this today. But I do want to let members know that if we don't finish these three bills, which I do expect we'll be able to, but we will continue at 6 o'clock tonight if we don't get through them. Next up is Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick, in regards to the trainings, the shaken baby syndrome training, the SIDS training, that would be given yearly, mm-hmm. are those trainings updated yearly, or would it be the same training every year?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, you know, certainly they're going to be updated now. I mean, we heard a lot about the training being outdated, and including the hairstyle and clothing worn by the people in videos that were shown. and so, yeah, it's all going to be updated. One of the things that I found interesting in talking with providers is that I had been expecting that they would be saying, why would we want to take the same training over and over again? I've been doing this for 20 years, you know, I could teach a class. But surprisingly, more often than not, I was hearing from people that, you know, this training is a good reminder, it's a good refresher. But nevertheless, it will be updated once, and I'm not sure if, you know, how often we'll be planning on updating that training thereafter. But, you know, we'll be getting feedback from certainly providers who attend the classes.
Real quick.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm probably one of those people who will be saying, why do I need to take the same training every year? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the question. If it's not going to change the year after I've just taken it the year before, will be the need to pay again to take the same training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Lohmer, were you on the list? No? Okay. Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kerber, one of my pet peeves in Health and Human Services is that we just love to recreate new titles, new language, yeah. and make it impossible for people to sometimes really understand what we're talking about. And, you know, I really am concerned about changing the shaken baby syndrome or shaken baby, you know, trauma to abusive head trauma, because unfortunately we still don't teach child development to most people, even though most people will become parents, so they'll be aunts or uncles or nieces or nephews or neighbors. And so they pick it up by osmosis and what's in the public entities. And many of them think that because you might grab and shake a 9-year-old to get their attention when they aren't listening, that you can do that to a child of any age. And when there is an accident, whether it's intentional by abuse or if it's just an uninformed adult caring for a child, and the shaking results in brain trauma, when it's reported in the news as shaken baby, it alerts everybody, whoa, you can't shake babies, they're fragile. And I'm a little afraid that when you say abusive head trauma, it sounds like someone who, you know, really dropped the kid on the head, intended to, you know, give him a fist. I mean, it expands the thing, and I think turns people off at a time when we still have people who don't understand how to appropriately deal with those developing children. And so I really would like you to talk with some of the public health people and some of the prevention people before you try and get another word and I think it just communicates. I think people know what SIDS is. I don't know if they'll know what SUDS is. You know, I mean, I just think, you know, we need to be careful when we're changing terms in language for which there's a common understanding, because you're going to be communicating with the public and the parents who are trusting their children, not just the providers. So I'm not asking you to take a position on that, but I would hope before you bring it back to us in language that changes it, that you would consult with a broader part of that, the community that's working to educate the public and parents.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And again, most of these bills will not be coming to this committee. I'm expecting they'll go to Representative Mullery's committee.
And
but
thank you, yeah. Madam Chair, for indulging me. When you said that, that's when I did want to be recognized, because I did want that to be considered.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Kerber. We're going to move to Representative Fritz's bill now. And let's see. Thank you. Representative Fritz, welcome to the committee. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would.
Okay, Representative Fritz moves House File 220, that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I just want to begin by saying that I actually had this bill a few years back. And as a wife, mother, grandmother, nurse, I have learned, as we all learn, in child care, it progresses. And I think all of my children were probably placed on their stomach and side and all of those wrong positions because we didn't know then. And we know now. And so I now have grandchildren. And believe you me, my children tell me when I babysit, I'm the grandmother. I'm not a child care provider. You know, they tell me, and they probably tell a lot of you, how they want this child cared for while they're in my care. They want them sleeping on their back. And I have had some that, you know, won't. But I've been taught. So as we go along in life, we learn better ways, and I guess the right way. So, but the bill that I had a few years back did not become law, and I had tried to put it into statute then that the child care providers that are caring for our most precious babies, infants, should place those children on their back. That did not go through. And then in the years that passed, then it became a parent notification to the child care provider. And then last year during session, I happened to see and hear and read a piece in the Sunday paper where this instance of deaths had really been increased, and it alarmed me. And so I put my bill back in. And over the interim now, I've worked with it and met with other child care providers and other parents who have lost an infant. So this is the simple bill. Current law requires child care providers to place an infant to sleep on the infant's back unless the provider has documentation from the parent authorizing the alternative sleeping position. House File 220 requires written documentation and authorization from an infant's physician in order for a provider to place an infant in an alternate sleeping position, period. So it's a doctor's slip, it's protection, it's liability, and that infant will be returned to the parents alive at the end of the day. And I do have two testifiers that I'd love to have you hear from, if you would indulge me.
Yes, please, Representative
Fritz. Right, thank
Fritz.
You. Would you like?
We have Lynn Barton.
Yeah, right that, here.
And Michelle Wilson. And however you want to do it, just introduce yourself for the tape, if you would.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Barton. I'm a licensed family child care provider in Douglas County, Alexandria. I'm in the beginning process of the Parent Aware program. I've received my child care credential, my CDA, my Minnesota child care credential, and I serve on other committees in Douglas County. In my personal experience of 14 years providing child care, I'm in agreement with having a doctor sign off on any alternate sleep position. This takes the responsibility off of the providers, and when the parents ask the provider to have their infant sleep in an alternate position, it forces the conversation back to the parents and the doctor, and it puts the child care provider out of that conversation. Having the professional or the personal relationship with family, sometimes it's hard when a family comes to you and says, "We would like you to put our child to sleep on their tummy." It's hard because you have that professional relationship. You don't want to say no. You want to do what's best for the parent and the children. And having that have that firm, you know, it's not up to me. It's not up to you. You have the conversation with the doctor. Come back with the slip. And that takes the child care provider's responsibility out of the equation. When talking with providers, you know, from across the state, many of them say they all want to raise happy, healthy children to the best of their ability. It's all we all want. The question is how to do that. We all want to reduce the possibility of an infant dying in our care. But providers also want to nurture the children and to do right by the parents. I look forward to a more robust conversation about all of the infant mortality legislative proposals, and I want to believe that a solution lies in the engaging providers and licensors and parents about safe sleep and training and making it accessible, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Hey, thank you very much. I'm not seeing any right now. So, Michelle Wilson?
Sounds good. Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon.
Members of the committee. Thank you for having me today. My name is Michelle Wilson, and I'm the Director of Especially for Children Child Development Center in Eagan, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Child Care Association. I want to thank you so much for allowing me to testify today in support of the legislation to require a physician's signature in order to allow child care providers to sleep an infant in any position other than on his or her back. The recent Back to Sleep campaign has offered an enormous amount of education around the risk of stomach sleeping and the benefits of back sleeping and back sleeping only. Child care providers still are allowed to place infants to sleep on their stomachs with a note from the parent granting permission. Although many providers have created a policy preventing this, the difficulty still arises when a parent adamantly requests an alternative sleeping position. This creates a struggle between the parent and the provider. Passing this bill will not eliminate every struggle that there is about sleeping position, but it will create another line of defense for providers and another opportunity for a physician to have the conversation with a parent about the real life and death implications of sleep positioning. It's another opportunity to expose parents to the education necessary to make an informed decision about proper sleep position. While there is some opposition around this bill, such as parents being allowed to have a say in their child's care plan, and parents are the child's first caregiver and they know their child's best, and sleep is important. Copays can be expensive, and a trip to the physician's office can often expose a child to unwanted germs. With all that said, requiring a physician's signature would still give the parents a say in the decision, allowing them to seek out another resource in support of their desire to sleep their child in an alternative position, such as on his or her stomach. Requiring a physician's signature would allow one more opportunity for parents to be educated against the risks of stomach sleeping, thus providing a second line of defense I discussed earlier. Discussing sleep position with a physician might also bring to light other medical conditions that are causing the child to have difficulty sleeping, such as reflux, ear infections, and thus. It may also begin to address the issues such as co-sleeping and items being placed within the crib, all of which increase the risk of infant death. Educating parents during prenatal care and during early visits with the child care provider can give parents the information necessary to discuss sleep position patterning with their physician at their child's well-baby visits, thus allowing parents to obtain that physician's signature, if desired, without having to create another visit or another copay. The goal being that parents would receive that education about the benefits of placing their infant on his or her back and the dangers of stomach sleeping, and ultimately result in the parents choosing to sleep their babies on their backs all the time. The American Academy of Pediatrics has stated that the implementation of the Back to Sleep campaign has dropped sleep deaths by 50% in the United States. Although sleep deaths are reclining, sudden infant death or SIDS mortality for children under 1 year is still the leading cause of mortality. This accounts for 56 deaths per 100,000 live births. That's kind of strange numbering. This means 2,500 deaths per year. That's 7 deaths a day. 1 in 5 SIDS deaths or sleep deaths occur while the child is being cared for by somebody other than the parent. By passing this proposed legislation, we're not taking away the parents' rights or underestimating the parents' knowledge of their children. We are creating another step in the process and another opportunity for parents to be educated on the benefits of back to sleep. The rates of sudden infant death syndrome during sleep are falling, but our goal as educators is to continue that trend and to educate our parents in the process. If this legislation can educate even one parent and save even one baby's life, it'll be worth the effort. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for members? Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question on the age. Is there an age limitation on this infant? Does that mean from birth till a certain age, or
typically we look at it till about age one?
Yeah, sorry, we have to go through the chair. Who's going to answer? Ms. Wilson?
Or Ms. Wilson, I can answer that.
Okay,
too,
Representative Fritz.
Madam Chair, yes, and it is from infant to age one, usually. And some babies are roll over sooner, you know, it depends, you know. But the law, it would be from infancy to age one.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill, either for or against? Anyone in the audience who wants to testify? All right. Seeing none, thank you. Representative Fritz, would you like to renew your motion?
I would, Madam Chair. I'm wondering where I'm going with this.
Yes. the bill is going to Representative Mullery's committee after this committee.
Very good. I'm thankful that I can move this around to bring this important piece of legislation to the members and then and out into the community. Again, we're educating ourselves and others. So thank you very much, members. I appreciate the time. Thank you both.
Absolutely.
Both my testifiers.
So Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 220 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, testifiers.
Thank you.
And the next on our agenda, Representative Fritz, don't go too far.
I got the other one. I got to get my bill. I'll be right back.
We're going to next hear another of Representative Fritz's bills, and that is House File 483. And Representative Zerwas is going to join Representative Fritz at the table to help present the bill. And Representative Fritz, civil law is going to look at this bill after we get done with it because there is a data piece in this. So the motion will be, if you're ready, are you ready to move your bill?
I'm ready to move my bill.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Fritz moves that House File 483 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. So welcome again, and please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I also want to thank our new representative here, Dick Zerwas, who's going to actually brought me this bill. He and the American Heart Association came by my office with the bill, and I was able then to meet this young man and hear his story, and I want you all to hear his story. And now I have his book, and I'm reading the book. You should all buy his book. You should bring a case of them. Bring a case of them. It's unbelievable. And I just want to, let me just start out. Personally, my husband Jim and I became great grandparents this year. On October 3rd, my granddaughter had an episode. She was perfect. Her pregnancy was going well, but she ruptured her membranes and the baby was 23 weeks, and so she was helicoptered from Faribault up to Children's, and Nick knows Children's well because he was there a long time. And so the baby and mother, the baby especially, finally was born through C-section a few days later, and 1 pound 6 ounces. Lily is her name. And she is alive and well and 7 pounds 6 ounces today, but she was in the neonatal unit for 119 days. And unbelievable. Yes, thank you. And it was fantastic.
You can't have any clapping.
The care is unbelievable. The care and the prayer, let me tell you, that is what got this baby through. And so, and Nick certainly in his life has witnessed all of that and more. And so what this bill is a screening to include, when an infant is born, a pulse oximetry reading, and that is to check the oxygen level in the infant. And in my life, and probably yours as well, you've heard of babies who turned blue and died or suffered some other injuries. And oftentimes from what I, in my nursing, and it's a long time ago since I've been in the hospital, but I, you know, the baby is born and it's put in an isolette and it's, you know, checked and it's the blood pressure and all things, but the oxygen level is never checked. And oftentimes what happens is the observant nurse sees a cyanosis in the child and is alarmed and then goes to the child, hopefully in time to save and resuscitate that child. But if they had an oxygen test immediately and throughout, they would be knowing what that test is. And actually, I had mine done over at the Heart Association was in the Rotunda yesterday, and I, you know, just, it's painless. It's $6 is what this equipment costs. You put your finger in it, and up comes your pulse and the amount of oxygen in your system. And mine was, my oxygen was 98, and my pulse was 79. So it's nice to know that about your health. So, but I'm going to turn this over now after you've heard my little story to a really interesting life story here to Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. Representative Zerwas, welcome to the testifying table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a different view on this end. And as Representative Fritz alluded to, for me, this legislation hits home personally. As I was born at Mercy Hospital in Coon Rapids, it was 3 days later, as I was being discharged from the hospital, that a nurse noticed that I was starting to turn blue. The color drained from my face. My lips turned purple. My face turned ashen. And my mom talks about this cloud of doctors and nurses kind of surrounding me as a 3-day-old baby, and her kind of following this group through the hospital until eventually I was being loaded up from Mercy Hospital in Coon Rapids into an ambulance and being rushed down to Children's Hospital in Minneapolis. And the doctors told my mom, "We don't know what's wrong. We think it's probably something with your child's heart, but you need to get to the ICU. You need to get to Children's Hospital as quickly as possible." And so my parents followed the ambulance to Minneapolis as best they could, and they got in. I had been taken through the emergency room and into the intensive care unit, and a doctor there met with my parents. My pediatric cardiologist, Dr. Stone from the Children's Heart Clinic, met with my parents and said, "You know, we have difficult news for any parent to hear, but your son, who you assumed was a happy, healthy baby boy, was in fact born with a severe heart defect. Your son Nick was born with a 3-chambered heart instead of 4. And it's a miracle that we caught this before your son was discharged from Mercy Hospital and out into the community, but we were able to get him down here and get him the help he needs." At that time in 1980, tricuspid atresia is the heart defect that I was born with. The life expectancy was age 7. They had 2 heart surgeries you could do early on and try to buy some years and get that on. So I've had 10 open heart surgeries total. I was talked that I've been told, my family's been told, now my wife and I have been told that I've had less than 6 months left to live 6 separate times. And the last time I just said, "Oh, come on. You guys will think of something." But back to the bill. What we're seeing now as stays after birth are getting shorter and shorter is some of these critical congenital heart defects don't manifest until 24 or 48 hours, but can be detected through low oxygen levels in the blood. And so it becomes important, if you look at the information handed out by the Heart Association, they want to test after 24 hours, but we want to get those tests done before the child is discharged from the hospital. But the difficulty and the scary part is, especially for residents in greater Minnesota, as they get further away from health care and away from access to pediatric cardiology services, that as some type of defect begins to manifest itself, things as a baby starts to sat down, starts to desat, things can get very critical very quickly. And what ends up happening is you have newborns that have suddenly presented issues, cardiac issues, that are being helicoptered down from Duluth or down from Brainerd. And so it becomes very touch and go, very life-threatening very quickly. And so with that, I think we have a few testifiers.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll bring the testifiers.
And let's bring the testifiers. We have Dr. Theodore Thompson. And then we have Jolene Tesh after Dr. Thompson. Welcome to the committee.
Oh, thank you so much.
And just please state your name for the record.
Surely. Theodore R. Thompson, MD, and a neonatologist, worked at the University of Minnesota. Madam Chair, members of the committee, and with me is Mary Filippo. She would want to come up. She's the medical director at North Memorial and at Maple Grove Hospital, and has been instrumental in working with this pulse oximetry study along with Dr. Kochilis and Dr. Lohr. I also want to say hello to all my friends that are here. this is quite a turnout. I thought, gee, I recognize a lot of these people, and they're residents, and they're our future physicians.
They heard
be
you
caring
come,
for all of us.
Mr. Thompson.
So they're wonderful people. So thank you all for coming. And these two stories were just remarkable. That's just fantastic. So thank you so much. You did more for this than we can ever do. So I will tell you that. The pulse oximetry screening, which we're talking about and implementing and need the support here for this particular bill, it actually started with a parent and an incredible advocacy to a parent that has taken it all the way up. Unfortunately, Anna Marie Saarinen cannot be here. She's with her child out of Boston, who's undergoing some more surgery types of things. But she worked closely with a number of individuals within this state, as well as the Minnesota Department of Health. And Amy, are you around somewhere, Amy? Amy, right here. You want to stand up, Amy, with big, oh dear, I'll mess up your last name, Gaviglio.
Yeah.
Has just been remarkable in pushing and working with us in the pulse oximetry study. So, few statistics and so on. I'm going to keep it very brief as we go through this. And we'll start with a baby that was full term, doing beautifully, pink, feeding well, breastfeeding, getting ready for discharge. We were doing this study in this state where we screened about 7,500 newborns in the past year. The parents said no, they didn't want the screening done. They said fine, we will understand that. And then about an hour before the discharge, they said, well, why don't you just go ahead and do this? Because it's an easy test. It's painless, done rapidly, sensitive, specific. It's a great test. He said, oh, just go ahead and do it. So the result came back low on this oxygen saturation, below what it should have been. We repeated that test an hour later, and this very healthy-looking baby, still low. We repeated it an hour later, so we're following the protocol, which is in front of many of you, still low. And at that time, then we called the primary care physician and asked that physician what we would like to do. We suggested maybe an echocardiogram. We talked about it together to make that final diagnosis. And that child did have significant congenital heart disease, was going to turn blue probably within a week or so, may have suffered a lot of damage to various organs in the body, was caught early, was moved into intensive care unit, and had surgery done. So very similar to what you were talking about. We had a screening test, and basically, I think, saved this child's life. And that's what this pulse oximetry test does. About 1 in 100 babies are born with congenital heart disease, and about a quarter of those have critical congenital heart disease. A quarter. And so in this state, that comes out to somewhere around 100 to 120 or so. Now, half of those will probably be picked up in utero or in the womb with prenatal ultrasound, about half. 25 to 50% are picked up prenatally of those children, but the others are not. We have physical examination that can help us. Big help. We keep repeating that, but it's certainly not perfect. And then we add in the pulse oximetry just before discharge and seeing if that oxygen saturation is normal or abnormal. Babies stay pink because they have very, very high blood, high hemoglobin. So they stay pink for a long time. They don't need a whole lot of oxygen to stay pink. So they can have low oxygen saturation levels and still be pink and really fool us. And that's what this test is all about. And that's why we're doing this. As I say, it is easy. You put on two straps, one on the foot, one on the hand. It's very simple to do. It's painless. It's non-invasive. There's no blood drawing done. It's quick. It's sensitive, moderately sensitive at least, about 70% sensitive, and very specific. If it's normal, the baby probably does not have any kind of congenital heart disease. Not only do we pick up any types of congenital heart disease, we can also pick up another disorder in the newborn period if there's a big difference between what we read in the hand and what we read in the foot, and that helps us as neonatologists care for the baby as well. So that's another big part of all of this. So it's a very, very nice test to do. And any baby who's sick, it's automatic. And many of you probably have had an oximeter put on, so it's also done in adults and can be very helpful in that regard. And I'm glad yours was 98%. That's great. It's nice and normal. That's above 95, so that's great. So that's wonderful. excuse me. So it's the early detection. It's the prevention of morbidity and mortality. It's a very, very useful tool. It has been adopted in at least 9 states altogether now. At least they've passed the mandate to do this test. There's about 21 states, including Minnesota, where it's in process of being mandated. It's been endorsed by a number of groups, including American Academy of Pediatrics, American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology, March of Dimes, CDC, NIH. It's come out in Lancet on a meta-analysis showing how effective it can be. So it's been very good, and it has passed the Newborn Screening Advisory Committee at the Minnesota Department of Health. So I think there's a lot of support for doing this just because of its ease and its accuracy.
Thank you. Dr. Thompson, I do have
questions.
Oh, excellent. Great timing. I was just going to say I have a question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Franson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I see that there's no parent consent here. There's no opt-in. While
they can all opt out and they can opt in. Either way.
The bill doesn't say that.
But it is a screening test, so it would be automatic with the screening test. They can opt out, though. Any screening test.
Right. Dr. Thompson, I think this is probably a question that would be more properly directed to the Department of Health, and I think Mr. Koppel is in the room.
Amy, do you want to?
Or.
Okay. Other questions? For our test, we had opt-outs, and they could opt-out or opt-in, so. We did about 75%.
Yeah. So I don't. I guess Mr. Koppel isn't here. Or
no.
Oh, you're there, but she's gonna. Okay. Well, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Joanne Bartkus, PhD. I am the director of the Public Health Laboratory at the Minnesota Department of Health. If you prefer to hear from Mr. Koppel, we can do that.
No, I'm sorry.
And
I didn't know you. That's all. Please
okay.
Go ahead.
And I do have Amy Gaviglio here, as mentioned previously, who knows a lot of the technical aspects of the screening much more than I do. With regard to the question about parental consent, and Amy can come up and kick me if I'm incorrect about this, this disorder has been added officially to the newborn screening panel by the Commissioner of Health, and it falls under all of the provisions of 144.125, which includes the parental options to opt out of the screening. And in addition, parents may opt out of the reporting, which was done actually as part of the pilot. There was a pilot study done in a number of hospitals. So it does fall under all of those provisions of 144.125.
Okay, Representative Franson? Okay. All right, thank you very much. And we have another testifier on the list, Jolene Tesh. And welcome to the committee. If you could keep it brief, please, we're kind of running out of time a little bit here.
Yeah, absolutely. Most of the key elements have already been discussed. So my name is Jolene Tesh. I'm here representing Lasting Imprint and the Minnesota CHD community. My personal story is something that I'm going to share with you, something that you may consider when you're thinking of this bill and the babies that it will be helping. We welcomed our second son on May 21st, 2010. He was a healthy baby at 8 pounds and 12 ounces. He had good color. He successfully nursed several times after his birth, but in the late hours of his birthday and the early morning hours that followed, he became very sleepy, unable to nurse. His hands and feet were very cold, and his breathing was very fast and shallow. I addressed to the nurse that my concerns, and I was, quickly calmed that everything is fine. That all babies, he's had a really tough day. I was exhausted, so I asked that she take him back to the level or to the nursery so that I could sleep, and that if he showed signs of being hungry, to please bring him back. It was at that point, what seemed only moments later, that she entered the room to tell us that something was seriously wrong with our son, and that he had been moved to a level 2 nursery for observation. At that point, we were told that we needed to come say goodbye to him. He was being transported to Children's. And when I walked into the level 2 nursery, I walked by each of the pink babies thinking, oh, that's David. Oh, look, he's fine. What are they? And when my eyes fell upon our son, I was completely and utterly horrified by what I saw. He was being intubated, and his... At that time, we didn't know it, but his body was going into multi-system organ failure. He spent the first month of his life in the NICU, allowing his body to get rid of the 4 pounds of fluid that he had built up from having multi-system organ failure, which obviously included kidney failure. He underwent one open heart surgery and multiple other surgeries, and was able to be with or was released from the hospital after 2.5 months. A very hard 2.5 months, but and we were able to bring him home on August 10th, 2010. And on August 11th, while he was taking a nap, he passed away. His autopsy showed significant damage to his organs from the lack of early diagnosis. We are incredibly honored that we got to be part of his life and that he was part of ours for 2.5 months. It was through him that I chose to leave my a decade-long career as a patent paralegal in pursuit of advocacy for other families like ours. I co-founded with a wonderful group of women that are in the CHG community a group called Lasting Imprint, and one of the things that we do is advocacy for our families. We're also facilitating educational trainings for medical professionals to be more accurately diagnose CHDs in utero. And we're building strategic partnerships with those organizations that will make a bigger impact for our health and our CHG warriors now and in the future. Despite the numbers of 40,000 babies born every year, or that 4,000 of them don't live to see their first birthday, no one ever stops to think that they might have a baby that's sick. In Minnesota alone, we have more than 650 infants born every year with a congenital heart defect. That's 2 babies a day in Minnesota. And sadly, one of them isn't diagnosed prenatally. And that baby has a 1 in 3 chance of going home. Pulse oximetry is potentially life-saving for these infants. Our CHG community knows that the best case scenario to have a diagnosis is as early as possible for optimal health for the infant. Early diagnosis reduces the number of mortalities and costs associated with delayed diagnosis, including surgical compromise, neurological impairments, developmental delay, organ failure, and long-term feeding issues. Every day, we see the faces of children that pulse oximetry could have helped. It's simple, it's non-invasive, inexpensive, and accurate to be able to detect critical congenital heart defects to ensure the best outcome of these babies. If you stop as a parent, for those of you that are, and you saw a nurse changing your baby's diaper, you wouldn't once think of the cost of that. Pulse oximetry is less than a diaper change. When you're at the hospital holding that brand new baby that forever stole a part of your heart, wouldn't you want to make sure that you give them the best start to their life? Although I wish that no parent would ever have to go through what our family has, the deeper wish is for the voices of the voiceless babies that I never want to see suffer the way our son suffered. If pulse oximetry is performed on all newborns and you have saved one life, wouldn't it be worth it? And you have saved one life, wouldn't it be worth it? If pulse oximetry was done on David, it's a very real chance that he would have been here today. That's all.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We really appreciate hearing your story today. Are there any questions from the committee? We have one more testifier on the list, and that's Twyla Brays. Is Ms. Brays here?
Thank you.
And Ms. Brays, before you testify, I just want to remind the committee and Ms. Brays that this is going to the Civil Law Committee. Ms. Brays, this is going to the Civil Law Committee, so data practices issues will be heard there and not in this committee. We're focused on the health aspect here in this committee, so welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brays. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and we've long been involved in the newborn screening legislation and what happens here at the state capitol. I would just like to say that testing is great, and I'm a pediatric ER nurse, and so I know the value of saving little lives and have saved lots of them. But our organization has to look at this in a long-term route. So testing is great, and our question is, why should the government be involved in mandating? And when we look at what happens when we set a platform for the government mandating treatments, then we wonder, where could this lead? Where's the next thing? In newborn screening, we are concerned that eventually it will lead to a full genomic screening of children. And so the newborn screening law, as a result of our 8 years of battle over the retention of baby DNA by the Department of Health, the parents finally have the ability to opt out. And they actually have the ability to opt in when it comes to the retention of DNA because of a Minnesota Supreme Court lawsuit that the parents won. So we look at this as a very serious issue when it comes to the government deciding to mandate what happens between the patient and the doctor. We also believe that this is so important to babies that we wonder, why is it that the hospitals or the insurance companies or those wouldn't be doing this? So why must we have the government mandating this and then creating, because I have to say this, Madam Chair, but creating a registry of those who have this condition. So, you know, we look at the whole thing, and then we look at, as well, at the bottom of the bill, where it talks about that the department is going to do follow-up services for 18 to 18 years of age. I do have a question, as I'm wondering whether this is going to go to a finance committee, because my understanding is that this is not free, that the cost of it could be up to $1 million a year. And I'm wondering if it would be going to a finance committee, because I don't see anything in the bill that would logically lead it there. However, it's very clear that it has to have money. So I bring all of those to your attention, our concern about the government practicing medicine, telling doctors how to practice, telling hospitals what they have to do, when it's a good thing, but that's not the way that we believe it should be done.
Thank you, Ms. Brays. Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair. And Ms. Brays, I did I hear earlier that we already have the opportunity as parents to opt out on any of these testings?
Ms. Brays.
Madam Chair and Representative Schoen, it took us 8 years to get that opt out. And we do have it now, but it's not exactly clear how it will be made available to the parents. Because we had the opt-out back in 2006, I believe, but the department wasn't making that available to the parents, wasn't making it obvious how they could opt out. So eventually we had to get an opt-in for a portion of that. So I'm not exactly sure how the department will be making sure that parents know that they have a right to opt out, as opposed to just having an opt-out in law that parents have no idea is there.
Madam Chair.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you. I think you should have stopped that. Testing is great.
All right. Is there anybody else in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill? Okay. Not seeing anyone. Representative Grunhagen?
I'm sorry.
Oh, there is someone.
We do.
I'm sorry.
Madam. A very short addition to those fabulous testimonies. So I had the great pleasure of...
Introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, thank you. I'm Mary Pilippo. I'm the university neonatologist, who's the director for neonatology at North Memorial Maple Grove. So I represent the institution of this screening over the last year for 4,000 babies in 2012. And I'll tell you that every nurse in the labor and delivery and mother-baby unit was very happy to do this. They were very happy to approach the families, have rolled out good practices and include the opt-out form with each of their voluntary screening. We also did a little piece with Care 11, and the mother that spoke was extremely pleased that her child was being screened, and that the families of those 4,000 babies, I haven't heard a complaint from single one of them. They're all very, very thrilled. We had 6 babies out of 4,000 last year that presented with symptoms. That's lower than you would expect, so I think we're picking up a lot in the antenatal screening. So I would urge you to listen carefully to the testimonies and support the bill.
Thank you
for listening.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question. What's the rationale for the follow-up to age 18?
Representative Fritz or Representative Zerwas?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Representative Zerwas.
Representative Grunhagen. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the follow-up is to provide the services that are necessary from a lot of the, you know, to treat a lot of these. I know in my instance, I can talk about me specifically, it's being diagnosed with a congenital heart defect at 3 days old doesn't end there. It doesn't end with your first surgery. Oftentimes it doesn't end with your second surgery. I'm 32 years old and I'm a patient at Minneapolis Children's Hospital. I go in and my feet hang off the end of the bed. It's the only place in the whole world I feel like a big guy. So I love it. But it is. It's a lifelong diagnosis. And we're part of the bill is to make sure that children are afforded the proper treatment and the treatment options up until age 18. But in reality, These patients now, especially, are living much past 18, and are going to be chronic users of our medical system in perpetuity.
Okay,
thank you.
Just one additional follow-up.
Representative Grunhagen.
I think it's a good test. I'm aware of the controversy about the the blood samples being kept as far as DNA with the MDH, but I think that something like this can definitely help, so I appreciate that. The what was I going to say? Is there a cost to it, though? Is it implied by one of the testifiers that there's going to be a cost to it? And if so, how are we addressing that?
But maybe I can respond to that. Representative Grunhagen, this is an item in the governor's budget.
Oh.
And so even though this particular bill is just the policy pieces, there is a piece that's traveling in the budget.
Okay.
So that will be dealt with separately. Representative Zerwas has a comment, and then Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up with the data concerns and the DNA concerns, just a quick reminder that in this portion of the newborn screening specifically that we're talking about today, in the pulse oximetry test, it is literally strapping on 2 sensors and documenting the number. There isn't a blood spot, there isn't DNA, there isn't any type of that biomedical information being collected or retained. We're looking to make sure that the oxygen saturation levels are over that 95%. I almost said I'm a pretty good looking guy. That's not where I was going with this. I look pretty healthy. I tell folks I have a face for radio and a voice for silent film. But in all seriousness, when I do the pulse oximetry test, I register 89. I'm low, and I feel it. But so what we're looking at is we're looking at that number and documenting that number and making sure we're not retaining any blood samples, any DNA, anything like that with this. We're looking at that number and making sure that we're not sending someone out of the hospital away from care when they desperately, desperately need it.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just was shopping in the audience here. And there's another, the version in the governor's bill is a bit different with a little more tighter data. And just And so those will be discussed and made to blend. And the monitoring to age 18 is an opt-in to have the monitoring. As a favor, you could choose that. Otherwise, you're not required to. So I think the work of today is to understand the value of the test, tragedy, and so sad about families who have lost their kids in this. And I think that's good work today on this. And I think the bugs will work out along the way. And I think we shall vote yes today.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Any closing comments from either of our...
Nope. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just going to say this. This is living proof right here. So, and the testifiers were phenomenal. And so I just want to, you know, move this bill along and continue down the path that it takes and to get it passed and to save those babies.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. So Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 483 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, we can't applaud in the hearing room. Sorry. We can just think of applauding.
Yeah.
Yes.
Members, we have one more bill.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Audience, we're not done yet, so if you're leaving, please leave quietly, if you would. We're still... Audience, we're still in hearing here. If you could please leave quietly if you're leaving.
Hey, good job.
This way.
Okay. The next bill we have up for consideration is House File 328. Representative Liebling, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 328 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Government Operations Committee. Correct?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
So, Representative Liebling, you move. We move that House File 328 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Liebling, please, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And this bill fits into our theme today because it's about a task force on prematurity that we have had in operation here. And I am just simply going to turn this over to my testifiers and let them explain what has happened on the task force and what they're asking to do here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm a contract lobbyist, and I'm here today representing my client, the March of Dimes, Minnesota chapter, and I have with me our state director, Martha Overby. I'm backing her up because this is her first time before your committee, and she's a little bit nervous, but we're here today in support of House File 328. We brought this to the legislature 2 years ago, and Representative Abler was the chief author, and I know he had to step out, but is very supportive of renewing the task force work. The task force has given its first report, which you have in your packets, and is doing work trying to reduce prematurity in Minnesota. Madam Chair and members of the committee, as we're trying to lower health care costs and attack one of the growing problems that we have in our state's budget and in the budgets of all individuals and businesses in this state, lowering the costs of health care can be lowered very quickly by lowering premature births, and that's the work that this task force is trying to do. I'm going to turn the microphone over to Ms. Overby and have her give you a brief outline of some of the groups that are a part of the Prematurity Coalition that have been working on this. And we know the time is of the essence. We don't know of any opposition to this bill. Representative Abler asked for one small amendment to reinstate some language that we had stricken, and I know that the author has spoken with him about that, and we'll deal with that after we've finished with the testimony, but we don't believe there's any opposition to the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Overby.
Overby. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Martha Overby, and I am the State Director of Program Services and Government Affairs for the March of Dimes in Minnesota. And I'm here today to urge you to vote in favor of House File 328. The Minnesota Task Force on Prematurity is a nonpartisan committee convened in 2011 to increase awareness of serious health issues related to premature birth and to evaluate and make recommendations on methods for reducing prematurity and to improve premature healthcare in the state. It is made up of representatives from the Minnesota Prematurity Coalition, Minnesota Perinatal Organization, and Human Services Health and Education Organizations. The Minnesota Task Force on Prematurity is currently being managed by the Minnesota Perinatal Organization, a multidisciplinary association of individuals and organizations dedicated to improving perinatal health. Premature birth affects 1 in 8 babies in the U.S. Thankfully, the numbers are a little bit better in Minnesota, 1 in 10 babies. These are our smallest and often most vulnerable Minnesotans. I draw your attention to page 2 of the report, the 2013. And as Phil indicated earlier, under the cost section, and I quote, in addition to prematurity being the leading cause of infant mortality and newborn death, the Institute of Medicine estimated the annual societal economic burden associated with preterm birth in the United States was at least $26.2 billion in 2005, or $51,600 per infant born preterm. Nearly two-thirds of these societal costs were a result of direct medical care services. In 2010, it was reported that 7,200 infants, or 10.2%, were born prematurely in Minnesota, which amounted to over $371 million in cost of care for just the first year of life. The most recent data for Minnesota shows a slight improvement in preterm birth rate at 9.9%, which is 6,980 preterm births in 2011. While this indicates an annual cost of $360 million, it is not inclusive of the indirect cost to parents and caregivers, such as time away from work and stress of caring for an infant born prematurely. In compliance with the mission objectives of Prematurity Task Force, has issued recommendations regarding prematurity within the state. In addition to extending the life of the task force by 2 years, which would be to 2014, the task force recommended specific steps necessary to improve the health care of infants born prematurely. These steps include continue activity to promote the consistent use of a disclaimer or discharge planning checklist, which is also in your report, it's the last pages, for late preterm infants, which would be 34 weeks to 36.67 weeks complete gestational age discharge planning checklist, as well as develop an electronic toolkit to serve as companion to the discharge planning checklist, which would provide additional technical assistance and references to birthing hospitals regarding the unique needs of late preterm infants. Incorporate the discharge planning checklist into the discharge process through electronic medical records. In addition, create a perinatal practice collaborative to meet recommendations on perinatal health in Minnesota. At a minimum, as well, require hospitals to submit data quarterly to the Minnesota Hospital Association on the number of inductions and C-section deliveries that do not meet medical criteria and need and that occur 39 weeks gestational. And finally, to encourage the development of public awareness strategies to raise awareness about prematurity issues and to continue the support and collaborative and with organizations in the future development of such campaigns or initiatives. So it is our hope that the Minnesota Task Force on Prematurity will be allowed to continue to serve as an effective collaborative committee that provides concrete practical steps through which to efficiently improve the healthcare outcomes of premature infants in Minnesota. Therefore, we ask for your support on House File 328. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Is there any questions?
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Lohmer, please.
Thank you, Loffler. Madam Chair, and Ms. Overby. I think this is an important area to pay attention to, and it sounds like it's initiated a lot of good activities. But in the new wording on line 2.8, its duties are to expanded to ensuring adherence to standards of care. And that's ensuring adherence is kind of an unusual responsibility to give to a task force that usually is you know, someone who has some oversight, accreditation, you know, some muscle, as it were, to incur it. And so I don't know if that's the right word, because it really sounds like an enforcement language, and I'm not quite sure what you were envisioning to take place through the task force in this, and maybe we could come up with some better words.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, again, Phil Griffin, working with the March of Dimes. Representative Loeffler, you have a very good point. We may not want to have that word, and monitoring may be another word, but you have in your packets, I believe, a handout that talks about the Prematurity Coalition and lists the groups that are a part of this, which include Abbott Northwestern and the Academy of Neonatal Nurses, the people that actually do the work in the hospitals. And so that's the reason we're using the word ensuring, is that we do have those people at the table that are actually doing the caregiving and working through and adopting those guidelines, and having them adopt them does help us ensure that it happens. But we're not wedded to the language if you or the committee feels that it changes.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Griffin. And I think since it's going to another committee, you can deal with it there and ponder what you meant. But maybe it's promotion and monitoring or collecting data on, or, you know, whatever it is. I just think you'll come up with something better.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler, we'll take that into account and talk with the author and work with you as we move to state gov op.
Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was gone earlier. This is just a wonderful project. I had the privilege of working with it before, and they're just it's kind of a white hat day for good things to do to make it better for little babies and help them give a chance to, you know, be born and then thrive. One of the things we worked on before on lines 221 and 222 was working with healthcare homes and pregnancy. And the reason these other ones are struck is because they're kind of done with that for now. I talked to the author and the advocates, and they're comfortable with reinstating 221 and 222. So, Madam Chair, I would move to reinstate the stricken language on lines 221 and 222, which will keep this matter of healthcare homes for pregnancies in front of the committee. I did quite a bit of work on it the last 2 years, and this is the best I could do for getting it somewhere. So. And they needed some wordsmithing later to fit into the new context. But I'll just, for today, if we can just reinstate that, then we'll wordsmith it later.
Okay. Representative Liebling, is that okay?
Madam Chair, I have no problem reinstating that language. So okay. If it's the committee's will, we can do that.
So it shall be reinstated.
Oh, we have to vote.
All those in favor of reinstating line 221 and 222, please say yes.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Thank you.
So moved. So passed. So, is there any questions from the audience? Any other testifiers?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there may be a question about the finances of this, and as we told Representative Abler, we believe strongly enough in this, and so do the members of the coalition, that we have staffed this committee with the health department, but they have not asked for additional staff to help do this, and we will continue to do that work without cost to the state.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Cool. So Representative Liebling renews her motion that House File 328 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Bill approved.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Members.
So, if there's no other questions or...
Good job, Madam Chair.
Committee is adjourned. Thank you.